Hello, everyone. I'm Paul Menzel.
And I'm Jim Conlon. And this is New Tricks for Old Dogs.
Our podcast features the many ways us older men and women howl at the moon.
Odd news items you don't normally hear about, and conversations with other old dogs who are growing bolder, not older.
So if you've got 25 minutes or so, grab a cup of coffee, pull up a chair, and join us.
In this episode, the old dogs ramble about 50s TV sitcoms that may have fomented major changes in the 60s. We wonder how the Supreme Court could confuse Jack Daniels and Bad Spaniels. We bring you another Ads and Fads. Our chief aging officer weighs in on the advantages of staying out of airports. And we question the wisdom of relying on ChatGPT for, well, anything. The Old Dogs conversation is with David Pelton, a man who sang his way around the world, enlightened the oil industry in good speech habits, and now helps our foreign visitors to speak English good. Well. Stay with us. All right, Paul, it's time for that all-important question. What is on your mind?
Oh, I thought you had another question in mind. Well, you know what I've been thinking about today? We have a piece about the Mickey Mouse Club.
Yeah.
And it started me thinking, you know, man, the programming in the 50s was awfully simplistic.
What do you mean?
I mean, it was awfully simplistic. What part of simplistic don't you understand?
I don't know. I'm a simple guy.
Well, and you know, the fallout from that is the sitcoms that we were exposed to in the 50s kind of perpetuated the myth of what a mother should be like and what a father should be like.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
You mean your mother didn't wear party dresses and pearls when she washed the dishes?
Can't remember that ever happening. but you know what I'm talking about. The formula was the all-wise father who had to come in at the end and have a sit-down talk with the kids about what life was like.
Yeah.
And the mother being kind of helpless about the whole thing. Oh, Ward, I don't know what's going on with the kids.
Well, that
the
seemed...
helpless mother who was a stay-at-home mother.
Yeah.
And the all-knowing dad.
Yeah.
And, of course, our real parents never matched up to how wise the fathers were in the TV shows. I mean, look at I Love Lucy. Mm-hmm. She never had a career in the series, of course. And every time she tried to do something to make money, she got into trouble.
Yeah.
Right? Unfortunately, that baggage from the 50s, we had to carry into the 60s, and that's when all that stuff was questioned, remember?
Well, now that you say that, I can see the connection that maybe people had had enough. Well, certainly women had had enough. Looking at all of these role models and thinking, wait a second, I don't want to be that kind of person or have that kind of relationship. Yeah, so in the 60s, of course, there was going to be a lot of protests and a lot of marching about that kind of thing.
Yeah, right.
Well, how did you feel personally? Let's say when you went to college, did you feel that that you were prepared to be an adult, okay, based on your experiences from TV?
Absolutely not. I think a lot of the values that I just assumed were acceptable from the 50s were really being questioned. And in college, you met very strong, smart women who didn't fall into that paradigm of what a mom should be like.
Hmm.
So, yeah, the 4 years I was in college shaped and knocked about, you know, what I consider to be traditional roles for men and women.
Hmm. Okay, well, how can we wrap this up? What do we take away from this experience we had in the 50s, Paul? Are you much better today? You got it all figured out?
Huh? I don't know. If there were a quiz, I think I'd probably get about a 65 on that one.
Mm.
The Supreme Court's decisions affect what's legal and what's not. They have the power to radically change life in this country. Well, except for this one case. This bod nugget is from the Washington Post for June 8th, 2023.
Well, the case in question began in 2014 and is titled Jack Daniels Properties versus VIP Products. VIP Products had a line of Silly Squeakers dog toys that mimicked beverages such as Corona beer and Mountain Dew. The company decided to add one that parodied the famous Jack Daniel's whiskey bottle.
Well, the resemblance was unmistakable. No one could have confused the two products. The squeaker toy was called Bad Spaniels, an actual bottle of Jack Daniel's as a label that reads Old Number 7 Tennessee Sour Mash Whiskey. The toy had a label that reads Old Number 2 on your Tennessee carpet.
Jack Daniel's contended that confusion was created because customers of the chew toy might think that it was a Jack Daniel's product. The Supreme Court agreed and sent the case back to the lower court. Well, I hope the justices took a nap after that earth-shattering decision.
For our ads and fads segment, we take a look at the Mickey Mouse Club, a variety show for kids produced by Walt Disney. It ran on national TV from 1955 to 1957. The kids on the show were called Mouseketeers, and everyone had their favorites. Mine was, without question, Annette Funicello. The show was hosted by a fellow named Jimmy Dodd, and each program had an opening march, followed by musical and dance performances by the Mouseketeers.
But can you remember the ending of the show? All the Mouseketeers were gathered on camera, and together they sang a farewell. What was it, and can you still sing along? We'll be back a little later with the answer. And now, more thoughtful commentary from Kathleen O'Brien, author of Reclaim Your Right to Grow Old and the website Grow Old, Be Happy.
I just want to go home. That was a quote I saw in a newspaper article about all the flight delays over this last July 4th holiday. You want to go away for a few days, but you end up spending the days at the airport, waiting for a flight to pick you up, then bring you back. Holidays aren't what they used to be. When I was growing up, we didn't have flight delays because everyone stayed home. People didn't try to make a day-long holiday into a five-day extravaganza. Grown-ups were happy with the time off, sitting in the backyard, kids running through the sprinkler, potato salad chilling in the fridge. At night, kids and parents would wave around sparklers and cheer our independence. Sometimes we'd go to a fireworks show. Not every town had them, though people didn't set off fireworks in their own backyards to compensate. That would annoy neighbors. While I'm on the subject, holidays, not fireworks, why do so many have to fall on a Monday? Martin Luther King Jr. Day is on a Monday, not necessarily on his birthday. George Washington and Abraham Lincoln's birthdays aren't on the same day, but we celebrate them as if they were on a Monday. And what do we do with these Mondays? We book plane tickets for a long weekend to go skiing or to sunbathe in Florida. Do we think about these famous men on their famous days? Some do, but I think we spend more time in airports waiting to go somewhere than celebrating the reason we're able to take time off in the first place. I say, let's put some meaning back into these American celebrations, Labor Day and Memorial Day too. Enjoy them. And give some thought to why these days are special. Stay out of airports for a change. And remember, you don't have to worry about getting home if you're already there.
There have been concerns that ChatGPT could be used by students to fabricate term papers. But no one suspected that an attorney might use it to prepare a legal brief. This pod nugget is from the New York Times for June 8, 2023.
ChatGPT is an artificial intelligence program with many uses, one of which is to generate content such as articles, essays, and summaries. Now, this can be useful for businesses that need to produce large volumes of content quickly. However, it was never intended to be a legal search engine.
The case in question involves a man who sued an airline claiming he was injured when a metal serving cart struck his knee. The airline asked the judge to dismiss the lawsuit because the statute of limitations had expired.
The man's legal team responded with a 10-page brief citing more than a half dozen court decisions in support of allowing the suit to continue. Now, when the lawyers for the airline couldn't locate the cases that had been cited, the truth came out.
The cases were fiction. The attorney who assembled the brief used ChatGPT, assuming that the chatbot could be trusted to cite real cases. Whoops! The judge asked if he bothered to verify the cases. The lawyer replied, "I did not comprehend that ChatGPT could fabricate cases."
Arena Raku, who directs the Internet Ethics Program at Santa Clara University, said that this case shows what critics have been saying. The vast majority of people who are playing with these programs don't really understand what they are and how they work.
Meanwhile, the attorney who filed the ersatz brief has an attorney of his own as he tries to avoid any punishment for his bad judgment. In his defense, he presented a printout of his discussion with the chatbot, which included reassuring words like sure and certainly.
At one point, ChatGPT said cheerily, "I hope that helps." Once more, artificial intelligence proves to be not that intelligent. Here's the ending for the Mickey Mouse Club. Karen and Cubby would first sing, "Now it's time to say goodbye to all our company." And then everyone would sing,
M-I-C-K-E-Y,
followed by Jimmy Dodd saying,
"Why?
Because we like you." And then everyone would join in,
M-O-U-S-E.
And I always shed a tear. David Pelton was, by many definitions, a successful opera singer and conductor who performed all over the world. But he found it tough to make a living at it. So he hooked up with the energy industry to help participants communicate better. Now his passion is to help people from foreign lands speak comfortably, confidently, and competently.
David, you and I have known each other for a while, but never really dug into your past. And you have had a fascinating past, my friend.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It hasn't been uneventful, let's put it that way. And as I've been thinking about it, I put it into three chapters. The first chapter was going to school and education and being a concert singer and conductor and so forth. And the second chapter, when I left music, which I did well, I performed all over the country and the world and I did well, but never really very, very well. So it wasn't a lucrative profession for me. So I left performing and teaching and I got involved with oil and gas people. I worked for a company called Petroskills. And I did communications training, meeting management and presentation skills. And I did very well with that. I did that for about, maybe 16 years. And that was basically here in Houston. And then you understand the word that you do. It was a forced retirement. I love that phrase. That's an oxymoron. It was a forced retirement, right? What are you going to do? And then my wife died about 4 years ago. And so the third chapter is working with foreign students and trying to improve their English. So I've done ESL work. So it's been sort of a, as you said, Paul, it's been all over the place. It's really been very varied.
Well, I tell you, David, there is a through line, which is teaching.
Yeah.
Through all three of your stages. But I would like to go back, if we can, to your career as a professional singer and conductor. How do you build a career as a professional singer?
Networking has an awful lot to do with it. You, of course, have to have the skill and the talent, but then it's who you meet, when you meet them, and the things that happen from that. And the arts are ruthless. The arts are extremely difficult because there are so many people who want so few slots. It's not easy to do. And my choice to do it professionally by myself, so I wasn't involved with a company or anything like that, it was hard because I had to make my own networking. I had a manager for a while, but the schooling has to be there, the technique has to be there, the work ethic has to be there, and the luck has to be there.
Conducting, though, is that's a different kind of a direction, is it not, from singing?
It is. Oh, yes. Very different. The things you have to know as either a choral or an orchestral conductor are legion. I mean, it's really huge. I had an opportunity, especially at Cornell, which is where I did my undergraduate work. I worked with an extremely good orchestral conductor, and he taught me, and I became quite proficient at being able to listen to an orchestra, and I had the verbiage. I could talk to people. I could work things out. So I really was pretty good. And I had a talent for conducting. I could stand in front of an orchestra and I could get a downbeat and I knew exactly what I wanted to hear, and so did the orchestra. I was given a scholarship to go into choral conducting because I was a singer at the New England Conservatory. So I swerved from orchestral conducting, which I still continue to do off and on, into choral music, which is where I got my master's and so forth. So I was more a choral conductor, and it was all because I got a scholarship.
Well, you were the itinerant conductor, singer for almost 20 years.
Tell
us about that decision. What was the point at which you said, I think I've starved enough?
Actually, when I came to the realization that I had starved enough, I went from job to job. I was director of choral music at several universities, colleges, and I also continued to perform. But it got to the point where, you're right, it just was financially impossible for me to continue doing what I wanted to do. So I had to make a decision as to how I was going to proceed. And I was a vagabond. I taught in New York State. I was in Virginia. So I've done a myriad of things. But I've always come back to, as Paul said, the teaching and being able to do things that I thought would be beneficial to myself and others. So I moved around Rhode Island. I got married. I've been married to my wife for 33 years. We moved to Virginia. She was from Louisiana. Connor, you loved her. She was from New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, was she a New Orleans lady. Mm-hmm. I mean, I tell you. So I went back to New Orleans to be with her. So when I was in New Orleans, I continued to teach to try to make ends meet. And I taught music to middle school students at the Academy of the Sacred Heart in New Orleans, Louisiana. And while I was doing that, I did some of this teaching for the oil and gas people. And what was good about it is that travel. Petroskills would pay me to go to Kuala Lumpur, would pay me to go to Singapore, would pay me to go all over the world to teach oil and gas people how to present and how to handle meetings and so forth. And it was, so that's where the money started coming in. And so I did that as well as teach. But then Katrina hit, and Katrina pushed us out of New Orleans. And that's when it pushed us here to Houston. And the company opened up a branch here in Houston, and they brought me on board full time. This company had about 400 instructors from all over the world in all the disciplines, you know, about upstream, midstream, and downstream. Really, really. They're one of the largest oil and gas development and training companies. And I had the pleasure to work with some of the instructors to improve their skills in the classroom. So I finally made money for a while, and it was enjoyable.
So let's talk about this last phase of your teaching, and that is ESL. Why don't you first of all explain it? Some of our listeners may not be familiar with English as a second language.
Well, that's exactly what it is. It's an acronym for English as a Second Language. It's working with foreigners whose English is not their native tongue to try to get to understand English, to speak English, to speak grammatically correctly, to have good vocabulary, and to literally speak a language that, quite frankly, is very, very difficult. There are 47 sounds in English. But for a foreigner to come in, such as my Japanese students or the ones who come from Guatemala or Venezuela, they're not used to those kinds of sounds. It's a very difficult language to speak. But ESL is where you try to improve people's English. English is a second language. And what you're hoping is that the ESL becomes really PSL, the prime speaking language. In other words, they're able to speak as well as they can in it, so they can think in it.
There must have been a moment there, David, when you discovered the possibilities in doing that. What was that transition point?
That's a good question. The transition point was music, and it was my training as an artist, my training as a singer, my training of knowing how to use the voice and what the voice can do as a communications tool. And it was nice teaching techniques and skills and all that sort of stuff, but to work with people and to get them to understand the value of sound, get to be able to speak properly using the right consonants, enunciation, and so forth. I found that challenging. And I found that more challenging than teaching a drilling engineer how to use a PowerPoint.
Hmm.
And the thing that I learned, that's a good question, Jim, is that because I learned patience, I was willing to be creative and find ways to get these people to get comfortable, confident, and competent speaking English. It's, you know, the hardest thing to do is to speak a language. So how do they effectively communicate what they want to communicate using the proper language that people will understand? That was what I found really challenging, because they have to be able to think in English. They have to be able to change wording in English in order to accomplish what they need to accomplish. And that's an advanced level.
Well, I taught ESL twice in my life, once in the 60s and once in the 90s, and it never occurred to me to spend at least some time talking about the different sounds that they may not be used to.
They have to be able to shape their mouths to make those little subtleties that change the shapes.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating. So there's a whole host of things that can be done. So to answer your question, I find ESL some of the most satisfying stuff I've been doing. I have what I call my three C's. And when you're communicating well in English, you're competent, you're confident, and you're comfortable.
Lovely.
One of the words I never tell them to use in English is sorry. Okay, and you know, the English say, oh, sorry, you know, oh, that's a sort of thing, you know. But don't you ever apologize for any mistake that you made. Don't do it. Because that completely is counterproductive to what you want to do. So if you make a mistake, so what? But the more involved they are in the learning process, obviously, the better they're going to learn. And so one of my challenges with ESL is that the teacher teaches and the student learns. No, no, no. It's a combinatorial effort, and you learn as much from them as they from you. I call my students storytellers, and I call them performers. And ultimately, of course, they're communicators.
You know, I was just thinking, there is kind of a through line from your work with oil companies to ESL, because my experience has been engineers treat English as a second language. they speak acronym.
it's an absolutely ridiculous, the acronyms they use. And of course, no one can understand the damn acronyms, you know?
Exactly.
To get an engineer to be able to be creative and think and be able to adjust and adapt, they're better when they do that.
Do you have some advice for folks that are in our age range? How do you stay involved with life? What do you suggest?
Well, let me preface that by saying my wife, as I mentioned, my wife died about in 2019. That's about 4 years ago. And I had, once I left Petroskills, my entire life was taking care of her. So I did nothing but that. I grew up a congregational. I grew up in the Protestant church growing up in Rhode Island. And so I have a heritage of that. When she died, there was a void, a major, major void in my life. And I didn't know how to fill it. And I realized that I had to do something to fill it. ESL did it partly. But the other thing that I realized was that if I were to get back when in a spiritual environment where I was comfortable and that had nurtured me as I was growing up, I might be able to move ahead and to do things even more solidly and comfortably and deeply. So getting back in some sort of a spiritual environment helped a great deal. So I don't care if it's religion or not, but as a person gets older, spirituality has to be there. There have to be things that give them some feeling of pleasure and enjoyment, and that's spirituality. If there was any advice to give to a person who's our age and who's getting older, stay active, exercise, but learn and grow and use the talents that you've had and keep pushing yourself. You are not nearly at the end of where you're going.
Like what you've been hearing? How about sharing the joy with your friends? We can always use more listeners. There are more episodes on the way, so stay tuned and keep howling at the moon.